You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Wednesday, 25 September, today 1956, the first submarine transatlantic telephone cable system is inaugurated. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Mateta Tulare from RMB. China, they cut bank reserve requirements. They are trying to push benchmark interest rates downwards, essentially quantitative easing. Sebastian Mullins, he is from Schroders Australia. What happened to that recession that we were promised, and is inflation really over? Andrew Moyles, he's head of research, New World Wealth, the Center Millionaire Report. These are folks with $100 million. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, the looming gas cliff in SA and the solutions. Effective monopoly that exists in South Africa, seen as a source of underinvestment, excessive prices and looming supply problems in three provinces. Business day, worst might be over for vehicle sales, says the Bureau for Economic Research. Third quarter retail survey shows an improvement in outlook for business conditions. Morning markets, US was green, S&P up 0.25%, NASDAQ 0.5%. Over in the east, mostly green. The exception is Sydney, down 0.33%. Tokyo up 0.33%. Hong Kong up 1.9%. And Tencent at about 22-month highs, up 1.6%. Commodities mixed. Gold, 2,686. Brent, 74.88. Platinum flat, 1,000. Palladium a little weaker, 1,056. Rand, 17.31. Bitcoin, 64,200. Top 40 opening call, 380 points to the up, 0.5% green opening.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chaining now with Mateta Tulare. He's head of FX execution at RMB. Mateta, appreciate the early morning time. As I said there in the intro, China cutting bank reserve requirements, trying to drive interest rates lower, essentially trying to stimulate lending activity. In a way, this is quantitative easing. It certainly got markets excited. Certainly has Chinese markets excited. I suppose, I mean, it is a big sign from China as they try and sort of kickstart their economy, which, I mean, really, since the pandemic has been lethargic at best.
Yeah, good morning, Simon. I mean, if you think about it, the Chinese economic growth has slowed and it's been dragged down by the real estate slump and the low consumer confidence. Now, markets have called for more stimulus, especially on the fiscal front. Now, yesterday morning, they did announce a flood of support measures in a red press conference amid a deepening economic slump. Now, you know, China will cut the amount of cash banks need to have on hand, which is known as the reserve requirement ratio, by 50 basis points in the near term. They did not indicate exactly when the central bank will ease the policy, but they said it would be in the near term. Now, depending on the conditions, there may be another, call it a quarter to 0.5% cut by the end of the year, the repo cut announcement, the most important move made during the press conference yesterday. Now, the net impact will depend on whether we see further cuts ahead or whether the People's Bank of China will fall into a wait-and-see mindset, especially after what they've announced yesterday. Now, the latest move by them is really aimed at reviving the country's economy, which has been, you know, grappling with strong deflationary pressures. Now, the announcements there could also provide some immediate relief to consumers, but it may also raise concerns about the profitability of banks, especially in the crisis of the real estate sector, which has really impacted the confidence of home buyers and also investors. Now, the cut that we saw was a move to really boost sentiment, since the challenge is not limited to banks, but also, there's limited demand for borrowing, but it's also outlining plans for further support for the struggling property market, which also includes extending measures for 2 years and also cutting interest rates on existing mortgages. Now, yesterday's, as we said, it was a very rare press conference. It was scheduled after the Fed cut interest rates last week. And also now that the Chinese government is also on an easing cycle that could also give, you know, this Chinese central bank further room to cut its rates and also boost growth in the face of all this deflationary pressure. So I think it is a step in the right direction, especially as multiple measures have been announced. Rather than them having, you know, spacing out these individual piecemeal measures to a more limited effect, I think there's still more room for further easing in the months ahead. We know that the Fed is also calling for more cuts. And I think if we see a large fiscal push as well as momentum, you know, it could recover into the fourth quarter of this year. Unlike the Fed, you know, the People's Bank of China uses a variety of rates to manage their monetary policy. Now, you know, the Chinese government also means that policy is set at a rather far higher level than that of financial regulators that spoke yesterday. So, you know, during top-level meetings that we saw in July, there had been calls to reach full-year growth targets and also boost domestic demand. So it will be an interesting story for the next, you know, 3 to 4 months before we close off the year to see how China actually stimulates the economy even further.
Yeah, and I take your point. I mean, they're aiming for that 5%. They've got a lot of levers to pull. I suppose the key point is can they do it? And then, of course, we're interested. If that starts to work, do commodity prices start to run higher? Mateto Tulari, RMB, appreciate the early morning time.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Sebastian Mullins. He's head of multi-asset and fixed income for Schroders Australia. Sebastian, appreciate the time today. I want to start with a topic which has completely vanished from the headlines. But if we go back 2 years, the talk was all of a recession. And it wasn't sort of would we or wouldn't we. It would it be a soft or a hard? Would it be a bad or a light? The recession's disappeared, or has it? Is there still risk of recession out there on the horizon, particularly in developed economies?
Thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me. I think the question about recession is an interesting one because the indication everyone was looking for was the yield curve inverting. Now, the question is, what does that actually mean? And it typically means monetary policy is tight. But if no one is levered, it's hard for monetary policy to really make anything break. So if you think about the U.S. consumer, I mean, first of all, they were helped out by a huge amount of fiscal stimulus. It's hard to have a recession with 6% budget deficit in the U.S. But at the same time, the U.S. consumer delevered after the GFC. They also fixed their home loan at around 3 or 4% in 2020 or 2021. So higher interest rates didn't really hurt them. And at the same time, when you think about corporates, they had very strong earnings. They had the maturity wall everyone was worried about, but they managed to refinance just fine. So both households and consumers survived the higher rates. So nothing broke this time around, and that's why we avoided a recession.
Now we're in the space where the G10 sort of central bankers are starting the cutting. We've just had the Federal Reserve, we've had ECB and others also on the cutting sort of process. Is it safe to say that this is now the trend that we're going to see, that inflation is gone, or is there still risks around inflation?
I think the inflation we saw in the past 2 years is gone. So think about those high rates, especially in the U.S., getting over 8 or 9%. I think that's a thing of the past. So definitely inflation is falling back down towards where it's been more recently. But I think the idea of inflation falling back sustainably below 2% in the U.S. is probably a thing of the past. So if you think about the last decade post the financial crisis, you've seen inflation or central banks struggling to get inflation up to 2%.
Yeah.
I think for the medium term, next 5 years or so, you'll see central banks struggling to get it down below 2%. 2% has gone from up the ceiling to a floor. And that's because we have see more fiscal spending more likely across the world. We see more higher inflationary impacts like onshoring, geopolitical fracturing, et cetera, likely leads to higher inflation. But I think that 8%, 9%, that's a thing of the past. But staying meaningfully below 2% is probably going to be difficult over the next couple of years.
And is it fair to say that when the central banks stop this cutting cycle, we're going to have rates that were higher than they were pre-pandemic? Because I mean, that was still, in many ways, still fighting the 2008-2009 double financial crisis. So we're not going back to those sort of crazy low rates in a sense.
Exactly. I think it's going to be very unlikely for us to go back down to those levels, especially considering post-GFC, it stopped the economy from falling into a complete depressionary spiral, but having low rates and quantitative easing didn't spur on actual economic activity.
Yeah.
So I think people and policymakers were less likely to agree to something like QE again, at least in its previous form, when they can do fiscal stimulus to actually help the areas of need and the voting population who keep them in office.
Let's turn to some specifics in terms of assets. Fixed income, let's start there. It's been a relatively good couple of years for fixed income. High rates you could get, I mean, the US 10-year and the like offering, you know, the highest rates in almost a generation. I mean, this is going to make it trickier going forward. Now, of course, yields coming down, it means bonds themselves go higher. But is that going to be a tricky space for those who in fixed income to continue getting the same level of return?
So I think right now, given how much has been priced in curves in terms of expectations for cuts, fixed income investors might be disappointed short term because I feel like, you know, 260 basis points worth of cuts in the U.S. is probably too much given at least our view on the economy being strong. That said, if there is a recession, bonds will still protect you. There's more cuts to be had if there's a recession. So if you're balancing a portfolio, it still makes sense to hold a fixed income allocation. Or you could probably buy it at better levels in a month or two's time if some of those cuts come out. So for us, it's more about you're not going to get those 5% yields you were offer a few months ago in the U.S., for example, but there's still reasons to have high-quality yield through fixed income in your portfolio with that potential duration impact if there is a recession.
What about other asset classes, and particularly, of course, equity? What does sort of cutting rates do for the broad equity class, which has been driven, I mean, it's had a stellar time, S&P's, NASDAQ, both almost at all-time highs, a lot of it Magnificent Seven. What about equities?
So I think equity should do well in the rate cutting cycle. With rates coming down, with the ability to avoid a recession and achieve that soft landing, that should bode well for equities. But I think importantly, as you mentioned, the Mag 7, or let's call it, you know, a handful of mega cap tech stocks have done extremely well. The rest of the market hasn't. With rates coming down, first of all, in the U.S., companies that probably struggled because of higher borrowing costs, if they're relying on bank loans, et cetera, they will feel the reprieve from low rates. So you might see activity in other parts of the economy pick up. So maybe it's an ex-Mag 7 catch-up story within the U.S. But also, if we're having a rate cut cycle around the world, that should spur global activity. So that means other countries that have been left behind might also start to play catch up.
Gotcha. Last question, US election, what we're about 6 weeks away from that. How much is that a risk to markets? I mean, certainly there's lots of hype around it. Certainly the candidates have got different policies. Trump, lots of talk around tariffs and the like. How much should investors be concerned around the US election?
So I think the US election, it kind of depends on by how much either party wins, so a blue or red sweep. Because I think if we have a blue or red sweep, these policies that we're discussing become reality, in which case you'll see a more fiscal deficit, potentially higher bond yield. That might cause a bit of volatility, but neither party's not looking to spend. So I think that's positive for the economy, but probably a bit of volatility in markets as we sort of figure out which way it goes. The thing is, Trump in particular, his policies of immigration and tariffs, that's done in the stroke of a pen. It doesn't matter if he wins decisively or not. He can do that if he wins. And that will likely cause market volatility. But ultimately, I think the market will focus mainly on earnings. You know, ultimately, that's what drives markets. And the earnings story is still pretty positive regardless who wins.
We'll leave it there. That's Sebastian Mullins. He's head of multi-asset and fixed income, Schroders Australia. Appreciate the time. And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Are you worried about a global recession in the near term? And beginning of last year, and I forget, weren't they saying it was like a 60 or 80% chance and it vanished? Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter.
MoneyWeb now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Andrew Moyles. He's head of research, New World Wealth. Andrew, appreciate the time. The Centimillionaire report for 2024 is out. Centimillionaire, $100 million plus. There's been significant growth since the last report of some decade ago. I mean, there's just over 29,000 of these individuals now around the world.
Yes, absolutely. The number of centimillionaires globally has gone up by 54% over the last decade. There are almost 30,000 of them globally, if you look at them just in terms of listed company holdings and cash holdings. So it's quite a high boss. There's probably a lot of people that are, in terms with private company holdings, that are missing, who are just focusing on listed company holdings and liquid assets. So on that definition, there's 29,350 centimillionaires globally, and the number's gone up 54%. And the number in the US and China is almost doubled when China, it's more than doubled over the last decade. In Africa, the numbers have been relatively static over the last decade, though.
And one area, I mean, the US always makes sense to top a list like this. China, sure. Europe, however, quite really lagging.
Yes, the European region, the number of centime engineers there in the last decade has gone up by about 20%. So it's been really quite slow growth, mainly due to poor growth in big markets like France, the UK, Germany. Mm. The number of centime engineers in the UK has actually dropped over the last decade, which is quite alarming. But there are some European markets like Poland, Malta, Montenegro, where the number of centime engineers has gone up substantially by almost 100% over the last decade.
It's a growing group. The numbers say that, and that makes a lot of sense. Also, they're moving. They, you know, they will not necessarily stay in their current country. This also creates, I mean, it gives them a sense of eliteness, but power, and probably, I imagine, some political power as well.
Yes, the billionaires, around 3,000 billionaires, they obviously have a lot of power. But when you think about the definition of what it is to be super wealthy, I think the 100 million band is often more important, especially in places like Africa, because there are only 20 resident billionaires in Africa. There are about 50 billionaires that are African-born, but there's only about 20 that actually live in Africa currently. But when you look at the centime millionaires, there's about 400 centime millionaires living in Africa. So in Africa's context, I think the centime millionaires are really interesting. If you take those 400 people, most of the big businesses in Africa have been started by those individuals.
And that's a good point. I mean, some of this will be family wealth inherited, but predominantly they've started a business and started with whatever, but have grown to become north of 100 million US dollars. This is entrepreneurs in many senses who've really made it big.
Yes. You know, based on our latest estimates, around 65% of centime millionaires globally are company founders, so essentially entrepreneurs. So basically, there are a much higher percentage of them are entrepreneurs than the general typical millionaire with maybe $1 to $5 million, which are often just from salaried positions. Mm-hmm. For people with over 100 million, as you said, some of them it's inherited wealth, but most of them, they're founders of companies.
And digging through, we mentioned China a moment ago, but more broadly, Asia seems to be picking up a lot. I mean, Hong Kong is doing well. Singapore is coming through, of course, China as well. We are seeing a rise out of Asia.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, especially some of the smaller markets like Vietnam, the number of centime millionaires there has more than doubled over the last decade. China, as we mentioned, is up 108% over the last decade, mainly due to really strong growth pre-COVID. So the time since COVID has been a bit slower growth in China. The number of centime millionaires in Japan has been relatively static over the last decade. It hasn't been great growth. But the last couple of years, there's been quite a bit of growth in Japan. But we're obviously looking at the full decade. But yeah, there are a lot of very promising markets in Asia, definitely.
A piece that came out, which really stood out to me, nearly two-thirds of the top 50 cities where these centime millionaires are living, located in countries offering investment migration programs, which seems to suggest that those do work. Because, of course, if you can attract these individuals to either a city or a country, it's a tax base. Quite possibly, it's also equally employment coming through.
Yeah, there's probably a number of facets to that. Obviously, there's certain places that wealthy people want to go. Mm. And so obviously, the governments of those countries have obviously worked out a way of monetizing that. And then on the flip side, you could argue that some of them have actually boosted their wealth by having these programs. It's a bit of a chicken or the egg scenario. It's difficult to prove either way, I would think, but it is quite an interesting trend, definitely.
I take your point. Maybe we're not quite sure which comes first, but we'll leave it there. Andrea Mullis, he's head of research, New World Wealth. Appreciate the insights. That's it for today. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us an awesome rating and a review in your podcatcher of choice. We'll chat again tomorrow. Outvest IPO.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.